for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. North Korea detonated its third nuclear device and confirmed its intentions to build ballistic missiles. President Obama announced another 34,000 American troops will come home from Afghanistan over the next year. And Pope Benedict announced his resignation. Joining me in the studio for the international hour of our Friday News Roundup, Michael Hirsch of National Journal Magazine, Kim Gottes of the BBC, and Matt Fry of the UK's Channel 4 News. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. So good morning to all of you and a belated happy Valentine's Day.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Thank you.
You have read on this morning, Kim. Let's start with North Korea, Matt Fry, and the fallout from North Korea's nuclear test.
Indeed. I mean, this is pretty serious. It's the third test that they've conducted. The first one was in 2006. There was a second one in 2009. And this one has people really worried for several reasons. One is that there's a fear that this might have been conducted with enriched uranium rather than plutonium. It is much easier to enrich uranium and to do it in an undetected way because you don't need a large nuclear reactor to do so. You can do it in military-style tunnels, of which North Korea has 8,000 of them. At the same time, if they're using enriched uranium, it's possible that they're going to do this on an industrial scale. And perhaps more important than that, they are trying to create small bombs that they can strap to ballistic missiles. And we know that they've made an 800-mile range missile, which was relatively accurate, unlike some previous ones. So the combination of missile technology, which is getting better, nuclear technology, which is getting more efficient, and a huge market for this stuff out there, and it's one of the few exports that in the past the Koreans have had, the North Koreans, has some people here in the State Department, in the Pentagon, and of course elsewhere, pretty alarmed, because the last thing you want is some sort of nuclear arms race in the region, in a neighborhood, which is already, as we know, from the Diutai Islands, an extremely volatile one at the moment. Yeah.
Absolutely. I think that it isn't just here in the US that people are worried, but also in the region. And the Chinese in particular, I think, are really trying to figure out how to handle this, because this isn't just a test for the United States. This isn't just North Korea trying to desperately get America's attention and get them to the table for negotiations. It is also, in a way, a test of China's new leader, Xi Jinping. How is he going to handle this? Is he going to continue to protect, if you will, the poorer cousin or brother down the road? Or is he going to be increasingly worried about the way North Korea behaves and the consequences this is going to have in the region? You know, is the region going to face an accelerated U.S. ballistic program? And that would really worry the Chinese. So they've got a fine line to walk here.
Mike.
Yeah, that's very true. And the White House this week, in conversations with me and other reporters, did attempt to lay a lot of this on the Chinese and how and what they would do to intervene, because this was an act of defiance to them. But this is also really an illustration of the failure of the Obama administration's first-term policies toward North Korea. They adopted this policy they called strategic patience, which was basically, we're not going to negotiate with you until you sort of unilaterally agree to suspend your program, and that didn't work. And now 4 years later, you know, we have this. And as dire as the impact is, what Matt and Kim were referring to, it's also a very serious matter in terms of the demonstration effect several thousand miles to the east, because an enriched uranium bomb is what Iran is trying to build. And even the UN Secretary General just this week, Ban Ki-moon, said this shows, you know, we have to take the confrontation with Iran seriously because of the effect that this could have on Tehran's own decision to proliferate.
John Kerry, the new Secretary of State, this week, if I'm not mistaken, the days seem to blend into one when there are so many world events. But John Kerry this week at the State Department said precisely that, that they were watching North Korea very carefully, that it was important to send a message that the international community would not allow non-proliferation because they wouldn't allow it on any level, including Iran. And that was very much a message directed at Iran. You've got talks coming up with Iran to try to impose limits on its nuclear program a bit later this month in Almaty in Kazakhstan. So as Michael was saying, this is also a test of the way the Obama administration implements its policy towards these countries that are proliferating. And adding to the concern is that North Korea, we hear this morning, have told the Chinese that they're getting ready to conduct another one or two tests down the road. So how much can you keep going down that road with, you know, the Americans and the North Koreans trying to figure out how to talk to each other and the North Koreans using these tests to try to get attention from the US?
I think someone once said that North Korea is a country that only a mother can love. And if one assumes for a minute that China is some sort of mother or perhaps stepmother, it is divided in itself how to deal with this errant child. Because there is a faction in China that was deeply upset by the fact that the North Koreans essentially kind of thumbed their nose at Beijing and said, we're going to do this test, and whether you like it or not, we're going to do it. And the Chinese said beforehand, we'd rather you didn't do this, and they did it anyway. But there's another faction that says, we quite like North Korea being troublesome, but not out of hand. What you don't want is for them to fuel some sort of regional arms race, which then makes the Japanese tool up and suddenly the Chinese get wide. And we've talked about these islands before. This is a real... These islands, by the way, which get ignored by everyone because they're called lots of unpronounceable, unspellable names by different people, Dayutai or Senkaku, I think, by one side and the other, are really important. Watch those islands because this could become... what the Crown Prince Franz Josef was in 1914 in Sarajevo, in a very volatile neighborhood with regional coalitions and sort of tectonic plates, you know, converging. It's very, very dangerous.
Exactly in the earthquakes that resulted after the bombing took place.
I mean, that's a sign that a test took place. That's how you detect whether there is nuclear activity. And the seismic magnitude of that quake was estimated at the scale of 5. It takes a few days before you can detect the radioactive cloud, if you will, and the nature of that cloud. So it hasn't been confirmed 100% yet, if you will, by the scientists that this test was conducted. But most people say, you know, the North Koreans, when they say they've conducted a test, they usually don't lie. They've conducted that test.
It's interesting because you had a Japanese official saying a natural earthquake normally starts with a small tremor followed by a larger one. This quake strength was the same throughout.
But, you know, the North Korean, you know, the mouthpiece of the North Korean regime, and I guess there are no other kind of newspapers in North Korea, said quite openly before the test, if the imperialists, and by the way, that's you and me, have intercontinental ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons, we deserve to have them as well. They stated this very clearly indeed. But just to get back to what Kim was saying, there's a kind of very nerdy anoraki point that's worth making, that it's very hard to detect whether a bomb or a nuclear test has been conducted with enriched uranium or plutonium. And the only way to do that is to test what are called the xenon gases that come out of this explosion in 10 or 20 hours after the explosion has actually taken place. But in order to do that, you've got to be fairly close to the site of the explosion. And that's the reason why they do these tests in tunnels, because it's not that you can't see them, because the seismic activity can always be registered. It's that you don't get hold of the gases, so you don't find out whether it's uranium or plutonium.
But we should have some perspective about this. I mean, this has been going on for about a generation.
Yep.
Since the early 90s, the Clinton era agreed framework. It has been a game of nuclear blackmail by which this long isolated country, perhaps the only truly Stalinist country left on Earth, and which is truly unique, has desperately impoverished economy, in need of fuel and food aid, has used its nuclear program. And of course, it's absurd that a country as poor as North Korea has one, and it can only have one because of the totalitarian nature of the regime, has basically said to the West, we're going to continue with this program unless you give us aid. And we saw various iterations of this, you know, all the way through the 2000s and up until the beginning of the Obama term. And in the last couple of years, realizing that its policy of strategic patience, that is not talking to North Koreans, wasn't working, the Obama team had begun to try to bring the North Koreans back to negotiation. And now it's clear they need to do a complete reset and find a new way to get back to the talks.
Wasn't there some indication early on that the North Koreans were prepared to behave somewhat differently, Kim?
Well, I just want to point out first that what was interesting to me about this event is that the State Department was actually informed beforehand by the North Koreans through diplomatic channels that they were going to conduct this test. And going back to what Michael was saying, what Matt was saying, it is a cyclical development that we see in this region again and again, with the North Koreans constantly trying to get America's attention. They want these bilateral talks with the U.S. I think that what they want is the U.S. as their mother and not the Chinese, but they're just not getting there. Yeah. And the thing is, for the Obama administration, it becomes very tricky. Well, are you suddenly now going to agree to talks with them now that they have conducted a nuclear test? It would be giving in to the blackmail. But if you don't talk to them, you know, how do you resolve this? I have yet to see any creative new ideas out of the box to address this. And we also have to remember North Korea has a new young leader
who is no different,
prove himself.
Who is no different in any respect whatsoever from his father, Kim Jong-il. That's what the other thing is that is demonstrated by these tests. The regime continues as it was. And so, again, it's another cycle of the same challenge.
And just to say, I mean, sons of dictators, I think, have proven often around the world, whether it's in North Korea or in the Arab world, that Syria, they are like their fathers.
Yeah. Kim Gade, she's State Department correspondent for the BBC, author of a forthcoming book on Hillary Clinton during her years as Secretary of State. Short break here. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Three journalists are here with me for the International Hour of the Friday News Roundup. Matt Fry, Washington correspondent of the UK's Channel 4 News. Kim Goddess, she's with the BBC. Michael Hirsch at National Journal. Do join us, 800-433-8850. A couple of emails on North Korea, one from Heather in Ann Arbor, who says, "My sister, brother-in-law, and nephew live in Seoul. Is this nuclear situation something about which South Koreans need to be worried? I read that both South Korea and Japan are making their military ready."
Well, the South Koreans are actually, as we speak, organizing massive military exercises, live fire exercises off the coast of North Korea to send a signal. And again, this is, as Kim said earlier, some of this stuff is cyclical, and indeed this is a cyclical response to it. But you don't need nuclear weapons from North Korea to obliterate Seoul, a city of, what is it, 10 million, 12 million people. There's enough artillery pointing at Seoul from North Korea, and quite a lot of artillery pointing the other way too, that can create a serious problem.
But how likely is it that North Korea would begin an attack on South Korea?
I don't think it's that likely, because there are also 37,000 American troops based in close to Seoul. So if Seoul is hit, some of them will be hit, and they can expect a very robust response from the United States.
One final email. Why is North Korea preoccupied with worries that the U.S. would attack it, Michael?
Well, because partly this is over the fact that there's been no formal end to the Korean War. The North and South remain in a state of, you know, formal hostility, at least, which is why you have all these troops lined up. And that's been part of the ideology, the liturgy that you've heard from this regime, you know, since that time, for the past 60 years. So officially they are concerned, but I think it's important to bear in mind that this test is really not about South Korea, I think, or even the threat from the region. As it were, it is really more a signal to the world, to the West, do not ignore us. You do so at your peril, and, you know, an attempt to, again, gain an opening to new talks.
All right. And while I was going to go to some other topics, we've already had a couple of emails regarding Pope Benedict's resignation. One from Mark in Easton, Maryland, who says, please comment on the motivations of Pope Benedict. I've heard some reporters say he may be attempting to have a more conservative successor by having a conclave conducted while he's still alive. It's my understanding he won't have any place in the selection of the new pope.
The Vatican spokesman, Francesco Lombardi, has already said this pope, outgoing pope, will not take part in the conclave. He will be still on the premises,
of course.
I mean, he's going to retire to a convent inside the Vatican walls. I mean, you can see someone in Hollywood is already coming up with a plot here. You know, it's got lots of intrigue and all the, you know, the mystery that you usually have. But of course, he's also, you know, I wouldn't say packed, but he has helped to appoint cardinals, you know, in his conservative frame of mind that will be sitting on this conclave. But then so did the previous pope. I mean, John Paul II wasn't exactly a liberal. So the College of Cardinals is packed with conservatives. One of the key questions will be is whether they'll go outside Europe, whether we might have the first African pope or indeed a Canadian pope. I mean, I think Ladbrokes are already taking bets on papal candidates in London, as they do, and it's the Africans who are winning at the moment.
And here's the other email. Did the pope attempt to cover up some of the sex abuse scandal in the early 80s? Did this revelation have anything to do with his resignation, Kim?
I mean, there is a very distressing record there, but I think that the decision that he made was probably very much linked with developments today with his health. I mean, he is 85. He has a pacemaker that we've heard about for the first time this week. He had surgery to replace the battery 3 months ago. He was apparently, the decision that he took to resign was made last year when he was on a trip to Mexico and Cuba.
Bumped his head.
He bumped his head. He had some blood on his face and he stained his clothes. And I think that just brought forward his sense of mortality. And he decided to abdicate. Now, you know, you have people who are quite divided about that decision because it is the first time that a pope decides to abdicate since 1415. And some people are saying, you know, is he just abandoning the boat? Is he quitting on a job that God gave him? How do you quit when your employer is God? And then there are people who say, well, actually, you know, this is really about trying to give a leader to the Vatican, to the Catholics around the world, that is strong and healthy, and the age will play a big part when the decision is made.
And what will his legacy be, Michael?
It's a good question. The caretaker pope coming after a pope you know, he once served John Paul II, who may well, you know, become a saint, who was deemed a great figure in history because of the part he played as Polish Pope in the ending of the Cold War. The man, you know, who began as Cardinal Ratzinger of Germany was never seen as anyone who was going to leave much of a mark, and he hasn't. Call me a conspiracy theorist. I don't like to come across as one, but I do find it rather ironic that a pope like this, who was seen and saw himself as such an upkeeper of tradition, would become the first pope in 600 years to resign, despite his age and ill health. I mean, we all remember how, you know, the end of the tenure of John Paul II, the man that he, Benedict, served. And he went down to the bitter end like many popes before him. I just find it a bit odd that he would decide to do this simply because he wasn't feeling well.
You know, or the bump in the head. But also, you know, just I think that's absolutely right. But he was very open about some of the reasons for his resignation in several statements that he made in the Vatican this week. And he talked in incredibly lurid language about the divisions in the church. He said the church had been defaced, that there were factions within the church that were trying to destroy the church. I mean, this is not the kind of language you normally expect from a pope, especially one who's just resigned because he might have had a bump on the head in Mexico. So there's something going on there. He didn't refer to the sex abuse scandal, and he may not even have been intending to refer to it in elliptical ways by using those terms. But I think, you know, if you take it all, you know, together, and we might find out more stuff in the next few weeks, it's possible that here is a man who was just too old and too frail to deal with all the stuff that was coming down the pipe. And so the combination of the stuff and his own physical health makes a fair, you know, quite a compelling argument to stand down.
There's more to the story, I think.
More to the story to come.
Lots of intrigue.
And certainly lots more to the story to come on Syria. Secretary of State John Kerry says he plans to bring a new approach to the difficulties going on. He's estimated some 90,000 people have been killed there. What new ideas are being floated, Kim?
I'm not sure they are new ideas, but they are new approaches. And I know they sound like the same, but a lot of these ideas have been on the table for quite some time now, and it's just about whether you can revive them and whether you can go about this a different way, because this conflict has been going on now for 24 months. There was one thing that John Kerry said this week that intrigued me. He was at the State Department, and he said, what you have to do is try to change, and I'm not quoting verbatim, but you have to change President Assad's calculation. Not about the fact that you want to try to convince him to abandon violence, but that you want to convince him that it's really time to start walking towards the exit and agree to a negotiated solution to this conflict. Now, how do you do that? Well, if you go back in time, when he was still a senator, John Kerry last year said that it was time to arm the rebels or create a safe zone, because unless the rebels had the upper hand militarily, President Assad would not feel the need to enter into any negotiation. Now, of course, we've heard recently about the divisions within the administration about whether to arm the rebels directly or not, because they are already being armed by some of America's allies. But it's about whether the United States wants to get more involved. I think that debate was painted in slightly too black and white tones. I don't think there was, you know, everybody
or on them or
well,
not
I don't think that Hillary Clinton, Leon Panetta, and David Petraeus all went to President Obama, banged their hands on the table and said, you have to arm them. And President Obama said no. I think it was one of the many options that were on the table.
Right.
And it was just the assessment was that it could work or maybe it wouldn't work. Otherwise, people like Clinton and Panetta would have pushed harder.
What the president was presented with were classically from the CIA, a set of different options and different levels of arming and arms. And he was told basically at the level at which the Americans would feel safe, in other words, where you wouldn't have highly sophisticated arms like manpads that could be used against the Israelis or even commercial aircraft if they fell into the wrong hands, that unless you went to that level and you were only supplying lower, less sophisticated arms, you wouldn't be able to tip the balance in this fight. And that was the debate going on inside the administration, which is one reason why, even though there was a divide, I don't think it was that heated, as Kim was saying. I just wanted to add, though, I think that we have a very, very different situation now because we have a different Secretary of State. I mean, John Kerry is not only someone who has met with Bashar al-Assad some six times, I believe, while he was senator. He's someone who is quite eager to engage in the sort of direct mediation that, frankly, his predecessor, Hillary Clinton, was not. And so I think you're going to see something different.
What about the status of a proposed meeting between Moscow and Syria? What do we know?
Well, there was supposed to be a meeting, wasn't there? There was supposed to be a meeting. There was a lot of optimism at the beginning of the week and at the end of last week about a possible meeting between high-level Syrian government officials and the opposition. And I think the chap is called Muaz al-Khatib, who's one of the opposition. He's recognized by the United States. And apparently, and Kim probably knows more about this than I do, this meeting was lined up and suddenly it didn't happen. And I think Kerry's been trying to get hold of his counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, for the last 3 days, and Lavrov has not been returning the call. So something has gone wrong. There's something inside Moscow that is, you know, that smells of trouble, basically, in terms of lining up these talks.
Maybe it's his meteor that has fallen in Russia.
Well, I would also add that there's very different politics and much more tense politics going on between Moscow and Washington right now, having a lot to do with, return President Vladimir Putin's sounding a tougher line, accusing the U.S. of internal interference in human rights. They had a big tussle over whether, you know, Americans could adopt Russian kids, which they decided to ban. And so I think that is all playing into the new difficulty that the U.S. and Russia are having over, you know, how to deal with what has been nominally a Russian ally, which is Assad-led Syria.
Yeah, just on that adoption thing, didn't Putin allow those already in process to go forward?
Yeah, a measured response. But nonetheless, just part of this very tough line that Putin and Russia have been taking.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's move on to Afghanistan. President Obama announced another 34,000 American troops will come home over the next year, and by the end of next year, our war there will be over. What about America's commitment to Afghanistan through 2014, Michael?
Well, there has been a formal pledge of strategic partnership, which was announced right after the NATO summit last May, that the U.S. will remain committed in terms of aid and support through 2024, which is absolutely essential, actually. I mean, the key point here, which many Afghans will tell you, is not to have the same sense of abandonment that they had after 1989 when, you know, the U.S. left having supplied the Muj there. That's very critical to standing off the Taliban, many experts say, is critical almost as having the troops. But what we have now is a situation where the president has said we're going to reduce by this time next year the troops we have there by about 34,000, which will mean we have about 32 to 34,000 left. And it's up to the generals on the ground to decide how to pace that. And then by the end of 2014, the U.S. will be down to a very small residual force that has not been determined yet, but it's almost certain to be less than 9,000 troops, whose entire duty will be at that time going forward to 2024, continue to help in the training of the Afghan army and to do, you know, special operations, counterterror.
It's always such a difficult balancing act to, satisfy the political domestic agenda, balancing what you need for the military to do its job in a foreign country, balancing what the people expect from the president here in the U.S., but also meeting the expectations and the hopes that you have raised in a country like Afghanistan. And it is always, as Michael said, there is a sense of abandonment when the U.S. suddenly ups and goes and, you know, heads towards the exit. And there is concern here that if the negotiations are not handled properly, we could see a repeat of what happened in Iraq, where there was an expectation that there would be a residual force, and by the end of that negotiation, everybody, you know, all the troops left. So there is that concern, and what that would mean also for a long-term commitment towards Afghanistan, which the Afghans are expecting. Of course, they feel ambivalent about the U.S. presence, but the minute you say you're leaving, then they're worried about what that means for their future.
Now, before we go to the break, let's talk a little bit about the EU and US plan to create an economic NATO of sort.
The sexiest topic of the week, no doubt. The EU-US Transatlantic Trade Agreement. Now, this is not a new idea, although many European diplomats listening to the State of the Union address, especially German ones, would have been tickled pink by the president bringing it up. It actually originally was mooted by President Clinton back in the 90s when he was talking about the NAFTA. People were talking about TAFTA, which would be, you know, the kind of the equivalent of that, but across the pond. And I mean, you know, it's essentially a reaction to what Asia's doing. It's the Americans and some Europeans, not all of them. And we'll talk about Britain's role in all this, which is slightly uncomfortable, the piggy in the middle. Basically trying to respond to, you know, the massive sort of Uber market of China and what Asia represents. So if you have the US and the EU acting together without trade barriers on strategically important products like brie and parma ham, this would be, you know, this would be fantastic.
But,
however, it's a really tough one to bring about because it's about, it's not just about lowering tariffs. It's also about harmonization of all sorts of things from, I don't know, I'm guessing here, the size of apples to the kind of things that the Europeans are really keen on. I mean, this is one of the reasons why Britain is cold on the European Union is because of this stuff.
The timing.
It's all about the timing, actually, because, I mean, Matt has a point. It is about trying to counter the rising giants in Asia, but it is also about trying to stimulate the European economy. This is the untapped stimulus.
Kim Gattis, the BBC. We'll take a short break. Your calls when we come back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. By the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
It is a self-evident truth that things which are equal to the same thing are equal to each other.
On the next Fresh Air, Tony Kushner talks about writing the screenplay for Lincoln, and Wes Anderson talks about writing the screenplay for his film Moonrise Kingdom. Both screenplays are nominated for Oscars. Join us.
It's time to go to the phones, first to Lambertville, Michigan. Good morning, Tim.
Hello. I was wondering if your guests believed that Korea and Iran felt that they have to have a deterrent ready before the Republicans retake the presidency, perhaps in 2016 or 2020.
Any thoughts on Republicans taking the White House?
Well, I think, I mean, that's an open question, but I think the lesson of the Iraq war against Saddam Hussein surely was that if you don't have your own deterrent, you're going to, or even Serbia for that matter, if you're not strong enough yourself, you're going to be more vulnerable. And I think that's the lesson that a lot of these countries took away from that.
But I'm not sure it really matters always in the eyes of people abroad whether the president of the United States is a Republican or a Democrat. I mean, in the end, America is a superpower and it will be loved and resented in equal measures. And Iran and North Korea have their own motivations and their own, you know, agenda, with Iran wanting, for example, to have more influence in the Middle East.
All right. One more call on that point to Ira in Fort Lauderdale. Good morning.
Hi. Hi. Back in the 90s, when Pakistan acquired a nuclear weapon, India made it very clear publicly. I think the exact quote is, if Pakistan launches a nuclear attack on India, Pakistan will cease to exist as a viable nation. Now, why can't the United States just say publicly, if we can prove that any nation used an atomic weapon against any other nation in the world, that nation will cease to exist? Now, of course, Russia and China will object, because when we say white, they say black, but they'll know we're not talking about them. And let any nation use an atomic bomb at their own peril. They're guaranteed peril.
Michael.
Well, I mean, that certainly is already implied U.S. policy when it comes to Israel, for example. You know, we don't say we're going to make you cease to exist, but that's the implication given the giant size of our nuclear arsenal, particularly compared to these, you know, relatively tin-pot countries that are trying to create one bomb. I mean, it's also the message behind the missile defense system that is being, you know, currently negotiated. But I don't think there's anything quite as toxic and, frankly, dangerous, because it's nuclearized, than the tensions between India and Pakistan.
Here's an email from Alan in Lauderhill, Florida, who says, as far as the nuclear ambitions of North Korea are concerned, please don't blame Obama. As we've seen with North Korea, Iran, India, Pakistan, and Israel, the failings are in the impossible ideal of non-proliferation. If a country really wants to get nuclear weapons, they're going to get them.
Well, that's precisely what people like John Kerry have been preaching against for years. I mean, this is something that, you know, if you think this is inevitable, if you take the fallible view, the fatalistic view of this process, then you will get into trouble. And, you know, if anything, you know, this latest test should concentrate minds, the minds of those who are serious about non-proliferation. But I think, you know, if you talk to people in this city or indeed elsewhere in Europe, the big worry is not so much that the North Koreans will use this as a threat against someone. It's that there will be a mistake, that something in the chain of command will break. And, you know, North Korean commanders, military commanders, and this is, after all, a garrison state, are taught, you know, by their equivalent of the West Point Academy, whatever it's called, to think independently for themselves. Now, if you're the North Korean commander, once you have access to these sort of weapons, who's not going to do something about a perceived threat, and it could be that meteorite coming out of the sky, and you think it's a ballistic missile, you just don't know. This is very dangerous, and add to that the fact that if these weapons are smaller and more efficient and produced en masse, it would be easier to sell them to other people and to proliferate.
And there is always the fear of the instability that it provokes in the region. When you look at Iran, for example, I've spoken to many people, experts, including in this city, who say, you know, the fear with Iran acquiring or developing a nuclear weapon isn't so much that we're afraid they're going to use it against Israel. A lot of people say this is just not going to happen, although it is something that you have to keep in mind, because it remains a concern. The concern, the real concern, is proliferation in the region. If the Iranians have a nuclear bomb and they're a Shia country, all the Sunni countries are going to want a nuclear bomb, because they're going to want to create a power of balance in the region. So that's what all this engenders.
I think you need to have some perspective here also, and I think actually the caller is mostly wrong. On the whole, non-proliferation has worked quite well. There are only 9 nuclear countries in the world today, and with the exception of Iran and North Korea, there are no other countries that are threatening to go nuclear, even though if Iran does, and Iran has hesitated simply, largely because of this intense sanctions regime upon it, then possibly you could have Saudi Arabia and other countries going down that road, but they're not yet. I think actually the intense focus on this, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, have been on the whole far more successful than many skeptics thought they would be. And in fact, during the past 4 years of the Obama administration, there have been some successful efforts that have not been noted to reduce or eliminate nuclear weapons material in a number of other countries as well.
All right. To a caller here in D.C. Good morning, Melinda.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I wanted to ask a question about the U.S. Transatlantic Free Trade Agreement that you're talking about,
sure.
TAFTA. I was just wondering if the panelists had read the high-level report about this TAFTA proposal, because we've looked at it and it's not about trade at all. There really aren't high tariffs between the U.S. and Europe, and so instead it's about what's euphemistically called regulatory convergence, which is eliminating the strongest consumer and environmental policies on either side of the Atlantic. We're concerned because it's really been a pet project for a long time of the transatlantic business dialogue, which is financial, agribusiness, pharmaceutical, chemical corporations, and they really see this negotiation as a way to eliminate what they call trade irritants. But the rest of us know that this is really the best food safety, environmental, and health safeguards on either side of the Atlantic. So I was wondering if they could comment on that.
Sure.
I mean, it isn't about tariff barriers per se, as Melinda mentions, because tariff barriers are already quite low. If I'm not mistaken, they're about 3%. And trade is already very, very high between the EU and the US, $2.7 billion every day. What this is going to do mostly is reduce tariffs maybe a little bit more, and even though they're already quite low, any further reduction will increase the trade even further. They're expecting it to reach perhaps $120 billion a day. But it is really about the non-tariff barriers, all those regulations that mean that, for example, car manufacturers in the EU have to abide by regulations not only in the EU but also in the US, which makes it more expensive for them and more difficult to sell in the US. It's also about labels, like, you know, Matt was pointing out, you know, Parmesan. Can you sell cheese that is called Parmesan in the US? Can you sell it in Europe? Well, actually, you can't at the moment because it is a label that is very much regulated.
So how good or how not good would this kind of a free trade agreement be?
There doesn't seem to be much opposition. Others may disagree. There doesn't seem to be much opposition because, as you have been mentioning, the economy in the EU isn't recovering as fast as people would have wanted. And as I mentioned, this is seen as a potential untapped stimulus, not just for Europe, but if Europe's economy recovers, then it has a positive impact on this side of the Atlantic.
I mean, in the past, things like GM foods, which is huge in the US, but people in Europe are very wary of, genetically kind of engineered foodstuffs, have been one of those sticking points. And if anyone out there listening has covered the EU agricultural policy, they know that this is almost more difficult than dealing with the Taliban. So, you know, there are some very tricky regulatory issues here, from manufacturing to agriculture to fisheries, whatever. These things need to be sorted out. And that's why, I gather, in the 1990s, when they were trying to make headway with this, even though the political will was there and the stimulus was there, the thing just sort of foundered in a morass of detail.
Yeah. I think all of that is true, what both Matt and Kim have been saying. But nonetheless, I think the political environment is more favorable now, not just because you have a Europe in recession with two successive quarters of negative growth, and really looking for, as Kim said, an untapped stimulus because of the official austerity policies they're forced to follow over the Eurozone crisis. But you also have here in the U.S. A lot of support for this idea. I mean, Mitt Romney, who people don't remember very much anymore, this was a keystone part of his plan to revive the American economy and create jobs, was to actually create what he called a Reagan economic zone, which was primarily to be with the countries of Europe. So I think you have now, and of course there's also the fear of China, you do have a different political environment very much from what it was in the 90s.
All right, let's follow up on that to Northampton, Massachusetts. Hi, Jack.
Hi, how are you, Diane? Thank
Good,
you.
Thanks.
The reason I called is I was just listening to the comments about the tariffs going over to Europe. I'm a manufacturer of a small medical device, and I ship to the UK, Ireland, England, all through areas like that, and I've shipped into the continent as well. But going into England specifically, because I got feedback on it from some of my clients, they were getting hit for tariffs as much as 7-8% of the cost of my product. And that turns into big money when they're paying $100 U.S. plus shipping. So, you know, I've had people say they were getting bills for $50 and $60. And I think if we do make a zone, you know, a trade zone, you know, that's going to be part of it. I realize possibly the other stuff, too. But it's very difficult to be able to figure out the wording and how you send stuff. Massachusetts has a an export council under the Department of Transportation, and they were able to give me the most applicable medical device tariff code number. And that seems to have been working for the last 6 months or so.
All right, Jack. Thanks for calling. Any comment?
Well, I think he just proved the point, didn't he, that there are going to be a lot of EU and American bureaucrats dealing with tariffs that are going to be very, very busy indeed.
Another,
for them, it is certainly a stimulus
another
package.
Another email question, would a free trade agreement with the EU require the U.S. to finally, 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 this email says, move to the metric system?
I would certainly like that because
you
5 years... 5 years Never. After moving to the U.S.,
Never.
I'm still very confused by your pounds and your miles. I'm getting there.
Yeah. What, you know, as we talk about Afghanistan, as we talk about Syria, as we talk about Iran, what is the holdup in the decision to confirm a Secretary of Defense going to mean for all of that, Michael?
Well, it's very troublesome. I mean, there's a NATO meeting of defense ministers next week that we will not have a defense secretary at.
Who will go?
It'll be a deputy, Leon Panetta's deputy. Leon Panetta, who had hoped to be back in California
attending
his plants by now, has been forced to stay on. And we're not going to know until at the earliest 10 days from now whether Chuck Hagel can be confirmed as defense secretary.
Do you think he will be?
I think he will be, but the longer this drags on, the longer it takes to get a couple of Republicans to break the filibuster, and they have indicated they would, and once the filibuster is ended, then there's no question about confirmation. But the longer it drags on, the more of a political liability becomes for the president.
Here's the question I have in this 10-day interim. Will Republicans actually get the information they're asking for?
It's a tough question to answer. I think a lot of the debate surrounding the confirmation of Chuck Hagel, which is tied in with the debate about the Benghazi attack, a lot of it has become very partisan. And I think it blurs the picture of what questions remain unanswered. I think a lot of them do remain unanswered. And I think that when it comes to Chuck Hagel's confirmation, but also John Brennan's confirmation, there are unanswered questions out there about, for example, why the president only spoke once with Leon Panetta during the time that the attack was unfolding in Benghazi. So they can put a lot of questions on the table that make sense, and they can put questions on the table that don't make sense. And then if they don't get the answers, all the answers that they want, then they'll say, well, we haven't gotten the answers. But it really depends what the question is. Some of them are fair.
But this has nothing to do with Chuck Hagel, who was a professor at Georgetown University when all this was happening.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. To Cleveland Heights, Ohio, good morning, Marie.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Getting back to the nuclear weapon, you know, if Iran wants to have it, Pakistan has it, India has it, Israel has it, then if every one of those countries had it, wouldn't that be a deterrent?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, you know, there is a rule, I think, in this game, and probably an unwritten rule, but it's certainly a rule, that you cannot attempt to have a nuclear weapon and make threatening noises about Israel's right to exist. You can't do both at the same time, and that was Iran's big mistake. Right. I don't think the West would have looked kindly upon any nuclear ambitions coming out of Tehran, even if Ahmadinejad had not said these things. But if you say that as clearly as they did, you're going to be in trouble when it comes to the proliferation front. And in terms of a deterrent, well, you know, as Michael said earlier, there is a form of deterrence. It's not perfect, but it's sort of happening. What you don't want to do is proliferate the deterrent landscape by allowing more and more people to have these things, because then it gets messy.
Yeah.
What I find interesting when you look at Iran and North Korea is that the Iranians, of course, maintain that their program, their nuclear program, is for peaceful purposes, even though they also make noises about, threatening noises about Israel. When you look at North Korea, they certainly make no secret of the fact that they want a nuclear weapon, that they're going forward with these nuclear tests. They make it all very public. And so it's interesting to look at the difference in the behavior between those two countries, particularly at the moment ahead of the talks, the nuclear talks in Almaty in a few days. Iran is walking this interesting line where they're trying not to be too provocative because they are cooperating to some extent with inspectors, etc. And then we're hearing about them, you know, buying new goods, magnets that
would. But if North Korea continues on its current path, what's to stop Iran? I mean, negotiations be darned.
Well, a very severe sanctions regime that has gotten much more severe in the last couple of years, now including a U.S.-Europe oil embargo. There's no question the Iranian economy is hard up. There's some, you know, its currency has been collapsing. The hope is that drives them to the negotiating table. But you're right to raise the question, because just last week, the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, effectively rejected a proposal by Vice President Joe Biden for one-to-one negotiations with the U.S.
There's also a very kind of nitty-gritty point is that the Israelis have basically backed off a little bit from earlier lines where they said we may have to use military intervention, etc. But they have a very clear red line, and that is if the Iranians manage to enrich, I think it's 530 pounds of uranium, which is enough to build a bomb, they will then intervene. And if they do manage to, or if they bought these new magnets and centrifuges that we read about, then they're getting that much closer to that red line.
Matt Fry, the UK's Channel 4 News, Kim Gattas, State Department correspondent for the BBC, Michael Hirsch at National Journal Magazine. Thank you all.
Thank you very much.
Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.